vis-a-vis Stevie Jackson. They have often been at opposite ends of different arguments. There is no doubt that they both appeal to different young groups of blacks in the North End. Stevie's the head of Soul. John is the head of the Black Blanks. The exact composition of these groups, whether there's any overlapping, what their activities are, and whether, you know, there are many differences of opinion between the different, you know, or in philosophy between the different, you know, constituencies is not easily recognizable. There must, in fact, be such a difference between the two leaders, Stevie and John. However, John's involvement in any compromise cannot be such as to lead to the placing of Stevie's head on the chopping block for Stevie. For John's dignity as a black person and his reputation in this community, as well as many and probably any other black community, would be not only jeopardized, but in fact his reputation would be destroyed if he were to sell Stevie down the road without his acquiescence, his prior knowledge, and his being persuaded that such a course of action was necessary. It is questionable at this time whether David Addison would agree to compromising Stevie or any of his people who may have been responsible for the damage. As I said before, John Johnson would not be willing to, as a matter of maintaining unity in the community, the black community in the North End. There has been much discussion, and in fact there has been a fight between, an actual physical fight between John and Stevie. This is as reported by John, and this is something that ought to be followed up on. Just last night, about 10 o'clock in the Union, this would be Sunday night in the Union, when much discussion was, or many things had been going around that Johnson was in fact selling Stevie Jackson down the river. I can only say at this time that Johnson also suggested such, you know, alternatives as a public apology that the black community might be able to make to the university.
Well, let's get very specific. You were telling us about the 2 a.m. meeting, and we know that there was another meeting the next day that Johnson apparently called. Now, you were talking to Johnson with Teddy Edwards, and now you're getting ahead of your story. Did anything else come out of that meeting?
Yes. Johnson at that time told me about a few very interesting incidents, which is descriptive, which are descriptive of the kind of power he says that he has, in fact, when it comes to dealing with the university. He said that the evening of the Martin Luther King assassination, he assembled a group of his people, of his, the ones that were in his political bag, a group of black youths in the North End. Many of them wanted to march on, possibly even attack, for all I know, either downtown Champaign or Urbana. At this time, Johnson told them to cool it, but instead take the North End. And what I mean by take the North End is just spread out in groups, small groups, and literally patrol the entire North End community. This is what they did. They were not interfered with, although it was in the wee hours of the morning. They were not interfered with by police. However, Johnson felt that the group was seen by the police. Shortly after this, or, you know, sometime after this, I don't know exactly when, Johnson once again assembled all these people, all these youths, and they marched to downtown Urbana. They were not followed. It seemed like in numbers, there were hundreds. I'd imagine something like, you know, a couple of hundred maybe, or 200-300 or something. I really don't know. But once again, in the wee hours of the morning, this group marched into downtown Urbana and marched back. When they marched back, they were supposedly followed by police, but the police never interfered with them. This type of march was repeated once again in the wee hours of the morning to the Union Building, where they were once again observed, but not interfered with. It is through, you know, showings of force such as this that John feels that he speaks with a certain voice of authority, as well as certainly having a well-educated view of how this university acts. He speaks with a certain voice of authority as a consequence of these events when he confronts the chancellor. There is no doubt, as he told me that evening and has repeated to me, that he has taken care of the interests of the black community in Northeast Champaign in terms of the 500 program. Originally, one-third of the slots in the program were reserved for Champaign residents. This was flying in the face of probably, you know, several legal rules binding the distribution of funds under this program. In the end, John did recruit some 80 persons, some 73 of them made applications, and 53 were ultimately accepted, I believe. This is tentative, since not only was it given to me, these are not only figures that are given to me by John, but there are also some applications which are supposedly under review once again, or that have not been finally acted on.
So he gave you the background of his involvement in the 500 program and sort of told you where he stood with the community. But the whole point of your having this conversation was to say whether or not it would be possible to have people who are guilty of personal injuries and of property damage brought to justice. And so now this is good background. Apparently Johnson's filled you in on where he stands, and you have suggested that he thought a public apology from the North End might be a possibility. Was this discussed at 2 a.m. Saturday, or has this come from your discussions with Johnson since then?
Well, this was discussed, you know, Saturday at 2 a.m. And my role in that particular discussion was trying to get Johnson involved in a compromise. He was hip to the whole idea and desired to, you know, meet with the people who could do something about it. Or bring the whole thing off. However, he did say that he would be very interested in seeing if something less than, you know, making some people in the community bear the brunt of the blame could be achieved. and he made it very clear that he wasn't going to sell anybody down the river without their prior knowledge and acquiescence.
Okay, now one point is important here. When we discussed this before you talked to Johnson, one of the points we kept making here was that the North End doesn't, it itself loses every time some of its hotheads beat people up. And if really and truly it is true that the same bunch of maybe at most 25 people have been the ones responsible for all the student assaults we've had in the last year, that Johnson and the Black End and then the Black North End in general have been losing and have been gaining a collective reputation which they do not collectively deserve because of the behavior of a minority. Were these arguments put forth?
These arguments were not discussed at all. There was some light thrown on that particular issue, the one of, you know, rowdyism, which was responsible, which certain segments of the Black community in the North End were responsible for. This was discussed in my conversation with William Williams, who related to me off the record that a daughter of his was in fact, you know, molested on the university campus and treated in a very, you know, very bad way. He told me that both he and his wife had been in contact with Roy Williams and John Johnson, and that Roy has ultimately said that it's ultimately up to them to do something about it.
Up to who?
The Williamses.
Oh.
And that he personally, you know, would probably have done something about it. John Johnson has played a role in the resolution of this type of problem by seeking to identify and has finally, in fact, identified the youths, the Black youths from the North End, which were responsible for the activity. I think
you
that
mean in this specific instance or
in this specific instance.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Johnson has got his it can be useful like this in many situations, and it is interesting to determine how much of an effort he is really willing to make in regulating the conduct of certain of his followers, as well as in protecting them when protection may be the best thing.
Okay, well, and I guess that really brings us up to the Saturday afternoon meeting, which apparently grew out of your conversation with him early in the morning. Do you know anything about this business in the union?
Saturday afternoon thing, to my best understanding, did not grow out of my conversation with him early that morning. That was planned ahead of time. It was with Rossman, and it brought together some of the mugged white students with some of the Black youths in North End Champaign who were probably responsible for the muggings.
Now, who set this up?
This was set up, I think, by Johnson and Jim Cornett.
Okay, that fits. All right. That had already been set up when you talked to Johnson.
This had been set up.
Right? Okay.
The only thing that we came away with was that I would go see Willie Williams in order to find out how Johnson can get in to see the Chancellor to begin bringing together those people who would have to be brought together in order to reach some kind of a bargain. Williams suggested that I made a call after I spoke to him Saturday, you know, for lunch. And he tried to contact the Chancellor. Wasn't able to get through the Chancellor. Talked to Lucius Barker, who said that John Johnson ought to talk to Joe Smith prior to making an appointment with the Chancellor. Well, I finally reached Smith with Johnson this afternoon. Prior to our reaching Smith, though, Johnson checked with Chancellor's secretary and has an appointment with the Chancellor tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for a very short period of time. And he also there is also a larger meeting planned for Thursday at 11, at which the larger group can take, you know, that can possibly reach some kind of an understanding.
Now, who's the larger group? Who do you mean?
The large group includes people like David Addison, I believe Lucius Barker, the Chancellor, naturally, and
Johnson and Williams?
Johnson, I don't believe Williams. There's a good division
Smith.
Of labor.
Smith.
I don't know if Joe Smith is even. Yeah, Joe Smith will be there. It's going to take place. Also, Bob Harden, I believe, who is a the employer of John Johnson out at the Antler Zone Clinic.
Yeah.
Now, this meeting will take place someplace near the Antler Zone Clinic, I think in the psychology lab of the university. It'll probably be a luncheon meeting, something from 11 to maybe 1 o'clock or so.
Okay. So what is being sought at this meeting is some assurance from the Chancellor that he will go easy on the charges as easy as he can. And once that assurance is given in exchange or anyway as a quid pro quo or both of them dropping defense mechanism, the black students will perhaps drop their threats of disruption should the Chancellor find independent evidence that specific people were guilty of things. Is that basically it? In other words, we are certainly not expecting Johnson or Addison or anyone like that to name individual people who are responsible for the violence on human beings and the physical damage, but neither will they object. And in fact, they will presumably try to cool it should tempers rise over the specific charges against specific people, should those charges be possible on the basis of evidence that the Chancellor's staff gets.
I believe that's probably true.
Insofar as you could understand what I said, all right.
Yes. Let me see. There's something I should add. One of the things that Johnson's interested in is BSA, the way it's going to go, and this is the relationship between the community and the university, blacks in the community and blacks in BSA, is very important to Johnson. These are very important things, and it's expected that he would want David to go out of BSA as some indication that the North End isn't picking up everything and getting nothing in return. He sees potential in the program, not only for the youths that are admitted into it from the North End, but also because of it freeing up the atmosphere here and providing a basis for some university action in the local community, the North End.
Okay, now, in your discussions with Johnson, did you ever discuss the BSA meeting Monday night? It has been alleged that that meeting, although presumably called by Addison, was packed with North End people, and that, in fact, some BSA members were prevented from entering the BSA office. This is the 7 o'clock meeting that was parallel to the meeting at ISR, which was a question of the 500 students. But the BSA meeting, it is alleged, was packed with North End people and dominated by them. Was Johnson present at that meeting, do you know? And if not, or even if he was, what role did North End people play in that meeting? Do you know anything about that meeting?
I don't know. There may have been an oblique reference to, you know, what was going on at the Union as well as what was going on at Illinois Street Residence Hall, but
okay.
I can't recall it, and I don't think it was significant at the time.
All right. Now I'm not quite clear on why it is that David Addison should go. When we discuss sort of vague things, like he's maybe not as interested in the community as Johnson is, and apparently Johnson did the recruiting of all the local black students, and the BSA was not so involved with that. But other than that, well, you see, if the obvious thought comes to mind, if you get rid of David Addison, who do you have? Mm-hmm. You see.
Let me say this: that it's there was a big row about Johnson's relation to BSA during this last summer, and there was a heated argument that they had over the phone, Addison in New York and Johnson in the BSA office. Johnson had discussed with some members of BSA a particular policy. At this point, I can't recall it. It won't be difficult to have him repeat it. And I shall, you know, have him do that.
Was it over the question of whether the 500 was to be 500 additional or 500 total students by any chance?
I do not know.
Okay. Well, anyway, there was a discussion with that. All right. Then what?
It ultimately ended up in Addison, making up a memo saying that we are students first. And in the last part of the memo saying, John Johnson does not speak for BSA.
Well, now where did that memo go? I mean, what was the point of that?
The memo went to BSA members.
Oh, okay.
Now, I think this involved Johnson's negotiating about the 500 program, possibly for the North End, possibly for more than just the North End. And I think it also related to who owned the program, whether BSA did exclusively, or whether Johnson as a representative, a spokesman for at least those people in the North End who had been enrolled in the program, also had some say about how the program would go and what kind of supportive things would be created under it. Now, upon returning there, David, backed down off this position, and John's position and David's position have never really truly been reconciled. I think they are epitomized but still, you know, their positions haven't been reconciled. I think they're epitomized in John's saying, if you are a student, you are my mortal enemy, and I will fight you, and if I have to, I will kill you in the streets. Using the same language and the same
ellipses
that he would talking to white people.
Yep.
Oh, that's all I have right now.
It is now 3 a.m. on the 20th. This is a Friday. I have just come from home, and before that I was at William Williams' house. I've had a long chat with Mel Reef in between those two. And today I went to Norton Long's office at 2:30 and met with William Williams and with Norton and with Cameron Satterthwaite. We discussed getting money from businessmen in the state, and I have a certain amount of homework I've got to do for Norton, who is going to go after a fellow by the name of Frank Castle in Chicago.
after that, I went to the center, slept for about 45 minutes, and then went out to the Gregory Housing Group where I had dinner, and I spoke to them until about 9, mostly about this particular project, the difficulty we had last week, but also about the general implications of that situation. And then at 9:30 or slightly thereafter, we went to William's house. And what I'm going to read now into the record are my notes, which exist on the yellow pad from this meeting, as well as some side things which I observed at the time. And then I'm going to, I hope, discuss what Mel and I had to say about this whole thing when I just went over these same notes with him. Okay, we learned the following things after the chit-chat got settled down and we got down to business. That, let's see, Williams and the Chancellor, Wynkankakee, and of course they came back to town about 7:30. We knew that before. At 9 o'clock, Williams went to the union. He talked with students, wandered. He went back and to the Student Services Building and confirmed with the group around 10. It was his impression at that point that the student group looked very rigid, frustrated, and uptight. Now, they were not asking to talk to people, but they were asking for specific action. And it was his recommendation that since the Chancellor could not give them specific action and would only be verbally shot down, it would be bad for him to get up in front of them because they would be left with no one in whom they could have any hope. So he advised against the Chancellor going over. At 11, Millett, Smith, Shelley, and Williams did go and had no luck. Then there was the bus stop, and his timetable on this is 12:30 for this first smashing and 1 o'clock for the real destruction, which he calls the breakup. Then, he says, after the breakup, he detected two moods. This means in the whole period after the breakup, I assume. One, the group of nonviolent conservative kids who've been upset about their involvement, who wanted to leave, just wanted to get out of there, but felt threatened by stories of rings of police around the building and therefore weren't moving. And a second group, B, ones with the metal rods, who were escalating their militancy. He says he had not felt intimidated, except perhaps for a brief period, until 2:30, but that after 2:30, around the edge anyway, there was a contingent who were getting violence prone. And so here, a second time, he vetoed the Chancellor's visit, and in fact recommended apparently that the police be brought in. He feared these kids. At 2:30, some of them had been drinking. He was afraid they would have it out with the cops. He was expecting real violence. It also mentioned by Williams, and I had heard this before earlier in the week, apparently from the Chancellor, maybe from Millett, someone like that, that there had been a 3 o'clock deadline given for the kids being given access to the food vending area, and there were threats of destruction to the rest of the building if that were not done. And I remember hearing from someone else at a previous time, not at this meeting I'm now reporting, that Addison had said at the time that he could not guarantee the safety of the union if, in fact, or the safety of the machines, if, in fact, the vending machine building were open. Now, it emerged at this point, I think I asked a question, and it emerged that the Chancellor and Williams didn't know even that there were financial problems on Monday night. The Chancellor may not have known even as late as Tuesday morning at the press conference. I find that perfectly fantastic. Williams feels that if Peltison had been brought into the situation Saturday or Sunday, he might have been productive, but that by Monday, with the emotions as high as they were, there was nothing the Chancellor could do. He went on to say that financial aids hadn't really promised that the loans would be less than $500, that they had said that they agreed with the BSA that this was certainly a goal to shoot at, but that, at least as he understood it, no promises had ever been made. And what he said further was that the financial aid people and the admissions decided to keep letting kids in even after they realized that the aid would be insufficient. They felt they were doing them a favor. And as far as he knows, the lack of aid was never communicated to the recruiters. And I will just remind us for the record here that there was that confrontation between Addison and Warwick and Company on July 28th, apparently, over the number of students to be brought in under this program. And apparently, Warwick and Company gave in to BSA demands that the number never go less than 500, even though, presumably by July 28th, they were beginning to realize they did not have the money for these kids. So they bowed to the immediate militancy of the BSA, one would assume, hoping that somehow or other the money could be found, or at least that BSA would understand their financial difficulties later on when that time came. That would appear to be the situation. Now, Addison came into the room at about this point. he had not been there earlier. The meeting, of course, had been going on about a half hour, 45 minutes. The statement had just been made by Williams in answer to a question from me that Millett also didn't know about these difficulties, and that, in fact, maybe no one did, because Shelley was basically in charge of the program and maybe perhaps failed to communicate things to people. Now, I just didn't really believe that. I said, as I understood it, Shelley was just in charge of program, not of either admissions or financial aids. And I wondered if if Millett, for example, knew about the situation. And the answer I got was that Millett was, quote, standing back, leaving the details to Shelley, that it was Shelley's program. Well, I suspect, and I will read this into the record, that Millett standing back here is rather similar to his standing back in the Virginia Drake Dan Perino situation, and that will mean something to me anyway later. Okay, Mrs. Williams at this point piped in that Williams, that Shelley had been sitting on info that people needed. Now Mel tells me in this conversation I've just had that in fact there is some evidence that Shelley was given lists of names by Joe Smith and by Willie Williams of people he might contact on campus, and that he never bothered to contact these people. So I'll just read that in for the record. Now then, when Addison, I asked Addison directly, is it true that Shelley was in charge of financial aids and admissions? And Addison